And he said, you're going blind. And there are no treatments or cures. And it was really, really set me back because it was like, you know, it took a lot of work to get to where I was, but I never, ever possibly imagined what that would be like.
This podcast is about the time we all get knocked down in life and climb up a new person. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts. Let me introduce you to Bill Barkley. You could say that Bill lives an adventurous lifestyle. He has summited Mount Kilimanjaro, finished the Boston Marathon 2 times, and hiked the 500-mile Camino de Santiago, just to name a few. What's inspiring is that Bill has a rare disease called Usher syndrome. He's both deaf and blind. Bill found his calling as a deaf-blind adventurer and co-founded a nonprofit, No Barriers, which embraces an ethos of finding purpose to get around obstacles in life, especially oneself. Bill Barkley, welcome to Belly of the Beast Life Stories.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me today.
Bill, I'd love for you to take us back to 1989 and when the doctor walked into the room and gave you the diagnosis.
Yeah, I wish it was always that simple, but it was basically an entire year-long process to get there. But I went to the mall, had an eye test, thinking I needed glasses. I flunked a test, and the woman at the retail counter said, I think you have something more serious. We left, and then my wife and I thought about it a little bit and said, it's a mall. But at sunset, I had a series of 3 car accidents. And the first time, I pretty much just thought to myself, well, the other guy. And I was getting those glasses to see, well, maybe that was something I got to do. So, but time passed. I had another car accident. And then I decided to pursue seeing a doctor. And when I went to see them, they basically said, you know, that something was up. There was something going on with my retinas. So now it's a little confusing because we'd done a couple of things. And so the nature of what they were talking about was so rare. There was no internet then. It was AOL dial-up living in the Bay Area. And so my wife pretty much said, you know, let's go to a very prominent medical institution. So we did. They specialized in rare diseases, and they said everything was fine. So we had our first baby that year, and we had just been, you know, adapting to that. And then I had another car accident. That time I pretty much figured I had it figured out that if I just took more right-hand turns, maybe things would be a little bit easier. And maybe I had something to do with it. But there's just always this nagging thing of something going on, but you couldn't quite describe it. So then we started getting deeper and deeper into it. And another doctor said, yeah, you've got a very rare disease and you need to, seek some help and figure out what it is. So we then traveled to the Midwest to another prominent medical institution. And then finally, they said, yes, you have a disease that's called Usher syndrome. And the remarkable thing about it was that over 25,000 people in the U.S. and 100,000 people in the world. And that it wasn't that was remarkable as much as that up until that very moment in my life, I just thought I was deaf. I had been deaf since the age of 5, 85% loss on the low tones, 100% on the high tones. And I had gone through my life being mainstream. I had gone to University of Southern California for college. I got a job with a Fortune 500 company. I was married. I had my first child. And I was like, you know, I had deafness. Not conquered, but I had it as a part of my life that didn't seem to be holding me back. And there I was sitting in this room, and I finally ended up on the East Coast at the final place where basically there was only a couple of researchers in the world looking at the disease I had. There was no genetic testing back then. And he said, yes. He said, you have Usher syndrome type 2. You classic case of going deaf before the age of 5. And then in your late teens and young 20s, you start to experience night vision loss. And he said, you're going blind. And there are no treatments or cures. And it was really, really set me back because it was like, you know, it took a lot of work to get to where I was, but I never, ever possibly imagined what that would be like. And we walked away from it pretty much shell-shocked. It's kind of like this PTSD kind of thing where it's like, you know, you don't know anything about it. You can't do anything about it. And it's an uncertain future. So we returned back to the Bay Area, and literally as I started to have the conversation with our coworkers and other people to try and figure out what my future would be at that point in time in 1989, the San Francisco earthquake hit. And I was driving my car at October 17th at 5:04 p.m. I had left the office just a few minutes before 5, and I decided that I didn't want to go by Candlestick Park because it was just going to be crazy with the World Series, so I crossed over the Bay Bridge, and then I went through the Cypress Viaduct, as it was known, which is the 880 at that time, they called it. And I was in downtown Oakland when the earthquake hit. And so it, you know, was going 60 miles an hour. It felt like 4 flat tires, and boom, you know, a disaster had struck in Northern California. And so, as we know, the Bay Bridge collapsed, the Cypress Viaduct collapsed, and a couple hundred people died, and I gunned it as fast as I could to get to my wife and get home. But it was just a very emotional year and period of my life of going through newly married, first child, career going well, disaster strikes down the rails as it relates to my health condition, and surviving one of the most significant earthquakes that had hit America in quite some time.
You had just had your first baby. You were living in San Francisco with your wife, Mary Beth, that you had married 2 years earlier, and you were diagnosed with Usher syndrome type 2, which is characterized by deafness and gradual vision loss. So this is the leading cause of deaf blindness in the world. There's no treatments or cures, and it just hits you and your family very hard.
Yep. It was brutal. It was, literally takes your breath away. Where do you begin? You know, you're a young man, you got a kid, you got a wife, you got to provide. Will I be able to work? How long will it take? What's the typical progression? What am I going to do about work? Will they understand? Will they help? Can I work in more capacity? You know, I mean, the question just immediately, it's like a tidal wave, kind of a flooding moment.
So what did you do for that first week?
You know, actually, there's a lot of parallels to that earthquake. You know, they shut everything down and nobody could go anywhere in San Francisco. We were underneath the flight path of all the helicopters going from Moffett Field to rescue those people on the collapsed freeway and their cars and stuff. And it was like life stopped. It was numbing. It was just, you couldn't process anything for long. It was confusion. Bit of anything from anger, a little bit of denial, a lot of internal hurt, you know, like just want to cry. It just, you know, it was just everything, you know, why me? Why my wife? Why everybody else? It was just hard to find any sense of direction and purpose. And, you know, it really is. It's just like your breath is taken away and time stopped, but my mind just kept going and not in a good place.
Where was your mind going?
It was just, like I said before, it was the mind was not necessarily all negative, but it was panic. It was racing. It was trying to figure out options. It was trying to rationalize. I'm kind of an organized, you know, logical kind of person, and also I have a fun side to me too, but it was just kind of like, you know, this is just daunting. You know, the prospect of also having to tell other people, you know, your parents, your family, your friends, you know, there were times I talked about it. It just felt like a death sentence, even though I wasn't dying. It was really about the realization about that life was not going to be necessarily on my terms and on the way I saw it going. And now I was being, I had this mountain that was being put in front of me that was even bigger than what I'd been through. I felt a little bit betrayed by, you know, why now? Why this? You know, I already gotten through so far and it wasn't easy. So it just kind of ripped open that whole process that felt like, kind of like you feel like you're making progress in your life and your world. And then you just realize, you know, it can change in a heartbeat. It can change in a second. And in my case, it did, because I just did not know until someone just said, this is what's going on. And you just didn't know it.
And I read a quote. You said, I can't imagine what it would be like to live with someone and watch them go blind day by day.
Yeah. My wife and I have had this conversation this weekend. It comes up a lot, because if somebody's emotionally connected to you and is a visible part of your journey, and you want to build a life together, we've got three kids. We have a wonderful and amazing life, but we also have the most unusual life, in a lot of ways when people look at us as well, you know. And so, you know, we say we're not the Joneses, but we are who we are, and we want to be proud of who we are and what we do, but it's hurtful in the wild, you know, the day that, you know, you can't drive anymore, the day that you have to ask people for rides everywhere, the day that, you know, it just happened last week, getting a ride and I got ghosted and, you know, there I am on the curb waiting and no one's going to come and I got to get another ride. Watching me go to a party or connect with family and friends and seeing how much work it is to go into, you know, a wedding reception with a band blowing and 100 people and it's dark and you're deaf blind and you're trying to be, you know, a part of the party and show up for game day. So they have to adapt. They have to watch. They have to emotionally process. And then there's the balance of helping too much and trying to help. And I don't think anybody gets a free pass, you know. I mean, I think a lot of things in our lives reverberate to the people on our rope team around us, which is, in my case, my family. And so for us to deny the deaf blindness as a part of our journey would be like saying that, you know, Bill doesn't have brown hair. I mean, it is who we are. And the sooner that we embraced it is probably the sooner that we found a place to realize that it's been more of a game changer as time has gone on than game over. But that initial moment, they asked me when I found out, it definitely felt like game over. I mean, but years down the road and experiences down the road, it's become a game changer. But, you know, it's a hell of a game out there. You know, if you go out to life, it's great. But life isn't going to come to you.
So, Bill, at age 28, you started losing your sight, and it was sort of a narrowing of your field of vision. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, so as it relates to vision, you're really talking about the ability to navigate the world, you know, in 3D objects and see and experience colors and drive and do all those wonderful things in an object-centered world. But as it relates to my vision loss, it's like the retina is like the film in a camera. It's all based on light is ultimately how much I will be able to see. So each person has 180 degrees of vision in each of their eyes, which allows them to take in and be a part of the world. In my most ideal condition today, which means a bright sunny day or incredibly great lighting somewhere, I have 15 degrees. So essentially, if I'm looking at someone, I can maybe see their lips, but I can't see their nose and eyes and lips. But if I look at their eyes, I can't see their nose or their hair or their lips. I have to focus on a very specific thing. And so because of my deafness that started so young, I was also born randomly, just a few doors down from one of the country's first World Deaf programs in the United States. So I was never taught to sign language. I learned to read lips. So my general navigation to get through the visual piece and keep track with the hearing loss piece is to read people's lips as a way to supplement and help me see and navigate. But if it's foggy, cloudy, dark winter month, you know, versus summer month, that can quickly plummet to zero within the same day. So I can be in a bright, sunny place in the middle of the afternoon, have 15 degrees of vision, but by the time sunset hits, I'm functionally completely blind and I've got my cane or I've got my guide dog. So I have to go into situations and contact all day long thinking about when am I going to encounter darkness? When am I going to encounter light? When am I going to encounter each? And what's my little strategy to get through them? So it's like a toggling of between 0 to 15, and I'm always trying to optimize it.
Do you remember a specific day when you surrendered?
I think the surrender is a process. It takes a lot of getting beat up, trial and error, going at it, sometimes succeeding, sometimes not, where you finally get to a point, you know, where you're going to do it. For me, that moment definitely did come when I decided to do my climb of Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa. It was 12 years ago, and I was, you know, in my late 40s. Most of the people around me have suddenly said, I want to go to climb Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa, and I'd never climbed a mountain. I'd never been to Africa. I had 3 teenage kids and my wife, and it's probably the most unlikely thing somebody would do, but everybody that kind of knew me at the time, I think 90% of them pretty much figured this guy's having a serious midlife crisis. He's deafblind. You know, I don't know. He's trying to figure it out. But I had basically come across someone in my life at that point who became a mentor, an extremely good friend, and has been a person that's helped me go on that journey to accepting not only blindness, but deafblindness, helping me see that I don't fear the end state. I struggle and have to live and optimize between now and that end state. And that is probably, it's like Chinese water torture. Every day you lose a little bit more hearing, a little bit more vision, and you have to, you know, go at it. And so, Kilimanjaro, I remember I was really focused on getting to the top, and I had told the world about it. I had generated some local news interest on it. I was blogging from the mountain. I was incredibly focused on journaling. I was in the ultimate, you know, adventure, mental, physical, spiritual test of my life. And I was struggling. I had altitude sickness, and it was the night before I had the summit. And I was like, you know, I had these moments of like failure. I mean, it's like, you know, should I have done this? And I was panicking in some ways, less oxygen up there. And I realized I had to calm down. I had to kind of get my wits about me. And I realized that, you know, I realized at that point in time, I was like, you know, well, if I don't make it, would I come back again and do it again next year? I mean, like, how determined was I to do this? And why was I doing it? And what it crystallized to me in going for this goal that was bigger than me and did different things was it told me that I wasn't doing it for these people. All these people that tried to help me through my training, figuring out whether zinc air batteries would work at 19,000 feet so that my hearing aids would work and whether I could use some night vision goggles because of sub-zero temperatures to see my guide's feet. All these things were, and everybody keeping track, they weren't putting pressure on me. They just wanted to be a part of the story, and they wanted to help. And so the minute I let go of what I thought the world was expecting of me to do that climb, at the time I said, you know, I'm going to do this. I can do it. I've made it this far. And it's not about them. It's about me and about finding a new direction, a new focus in my life. And I was realizing that my talents and my gift were going in a totally different direction. I had a wonderful career with a company and things that I did that I had learned a lot. But it was turning out that it wasn't enough, and I didn't know it yet. I mean, this process takes years of just keep going at it and keep going at it. But the moment I just said, you know, deafblindness is what it is. It did not define me. It's really when I was on the side of Kilimanjaro, and that's what I've embraced ever since in these last 12 years, is you can call me a lot of things. A father, a son, a husband, a community member, a board member. You can call me some not so nice name. You can call me some good name. You can call me deaf. You can call me blind. They're just ways that people describe me, but it doesn't have to define me. I define myself every day by what I do and where I go. And so that was probably the most powerful moment, was realizing that there was a reason I did this project. And it was really about finding myself. And in finding myself, I could try and get to a better place.
I want to read a quote that you made, which really moved me. And then I'd love for you just to open it up about adventures in your life. You said, you have a choice, and the choice is to let it take your life from you, or you can say, yes, there are some realities to the disease and to the situation that I face, but I can do things that you never thought were possible.
Absolutely. I think that Kilimanjaro, you know, one of the insights that we've been talking about is defining yourself, but it's also about that time when you make the decision to live, you know, that life is worth having and that you really can't imagine it not being there. But also doing that in light of not seeing yourself as a liability. You know, it's really one of these things where that probably 90% of the battles that I have faced or I've seen and people I've worked with challenges over the years come to the realization of is that 90% of the time, the biggest barrier or obstacle to the challenges we face is ourselves. And it's somewhere rooted within our self-esteem, or it's rooted in societal expectations or perception. And that as a result of it, you know, there's all kinds of messages about, you know, you can't do that, you shouldn't do that, and nobody's done that. And part of the fun is actually doing it and surprising people. But you have to decide that you want to do it. It's going to be bloody. It's going to be messy. It's going to be fun. It's going to be chaotic. It's going to be hectic. It's going to be all of your life's emotions rolled up in one. But if it's used with some level of a focus to get somewhere, then it's going to get you to feeling that you're living and being a part of life. So I have to be clear that, you know, the adventure is an easy way to say that I would be like an adventure thrill seeker. They want to go after, you know, Mount Kilimanjaro. And I have to tell you that there's a component of me that does like my, you know, athletic part of things and the athletic testosterone and testosterone-inducing feeling you can get, you know, like a runner's high. But really, that's not what it's about. It's really about the realization that if I knew that I got to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, I had set the goal that I was going to share a message about a deafblind man to be the first person to get up Kilimanjaro. And I was going to share stories with people about how the assistive technologies that I used, which were night vision goggles that the military was using in Iraq, that I could get on a prescription basis so I could see my guide's feet so I could climb up, and that I could use wireless Bluetooth technology, which was brand new back then, before all the GPS and everything we take for granted today. If I could hear on a telephone for the first time by Bluetooth or listen to music without headphones for the first time in my life, I decided I wanted to share that message to tell people that were deaf and blind, hey, there's ways to adapt, modify, and live. And if we get creative and resilient and determined and persistent, there's really no reason you can't do anything. So that, for me, was really what the adventure piece has led me to move forward with, which is about every single adventure I do, I pick a purpose and a specific message, group, or cause that I want to highlight, because it's in service of other people that I get the greatest reward. And I find that when I hit those pockets of walls where it's telling me you can't do this, it's difficult, it's not going to happen, what's going to power me is not my individual desire for athleticism or the adrenaline and the testosterone type of thing. It's going to be the knowledge of knowing that I made a small impact and I can help other people. And if one other person gets hearing aids or one other person finds that they can get out even though they're blind and enjoy the outdoors, then it's been for good. Because I do believe that all of us, regardless of who we are, as a human being, look for a few things. One is significant, meaning, and impact. And when the world is telling us that you're not as able, or you're not as capable, or that you can't do it, or that you think you can't, and everything else, it diminishes our value and our potential. Who doesn't want to have significance in someone else's life? Who doesn't want to have meaning in the world, that as crazy as it is everywhere around, that you run in and go to work or do something, that you mean something to somebody? Or that you came up with a great idea or changed the course of something that happened to help someone else do something they never thought possible. Impact is powerful. We get great gifts by taking on challenges and adversity and mountains in our lives. we get the reward of knowing that we can make ourselves and other people on the human journey better, more satisfied, happier, and fulfilled. So that's why I do adventures.
How did these constraints make your life richer?
Well, in realizing that, you know, I'm not going to do it the same way, it becomes a fun challenge. You know, it's this whole thing. If I'm going to reach for new heights, new skills, or experiences, I find myself getting innovative, getting creative. I find myself, you know, prototyping, testing. I like the idea of tinkering and playing around and figuring out how I am going to do it. Because a lot of times, nobody's going to tell me how to do it because it's never been done before. But that doesn't mean don't do it. You know, it's like, you know, I'm going through 6 ecosystems of Kilimanjaro. You know, I got hearing aids and I got night vision technology. What am I going to do about, you know, rain? What am I going to do about wind? What am I going to do about snow? I live on batteries in my hearing aid. What do I do if my gear gets wet? You know, what am I going to do about seeing when it's dark? And what am I going to do when it's daylight and all these other elements? And so by thinking through the experience ahead of time, I use my skills of planning and organizing and start to imagine an experience I never had. But then I start thinking about plan A, plan B, plan C. And it's in using my mind that I find that those small steps are engaging me into the bigger part of the world. And in engaging in the bigger part of the world, it's not passive. And that's why I like to talk about, you know, life isn't going to come to me. I'm deafblind. People will give me resources. They'll help me, or they'll tell me that, you know, they would provide social nets or whatever might be out there. But at the end of the day, whether you have a disease or whether you have a challenge or you've been through a car accident, whatever you might have had is a major thing to change the course of your life. You know, it's important to just realize life doesn't come to you. We are tasked with the purpose of making the life. And so I can't think of anything but go forward. And sometimes I go forward and I find myself spinning 50 yards. And sometimes I go forward and I fall flat on my ass and go back 50 yards. But to me, that's part of the adventure. That's part of the fun. It hones me. It refines me. It forces me to prioritize. It also makes me realize how important it is to me. If it isn't that important to me, then I probably give up. But if I give up, I better understand why I'm giving up. Because giving up never feels good. But understanding why you give up can be just as important as pushing on.
So, Bill, after Mount Kilimanjaro, you've done a number of things, right? That was kind of the beginning of your adventure drive. So a few of those were first deafblind person to run and finish the Boston Marathon. And then you did it again 2 years later. The Camino del Santiago in Spain. What are some of the highlights of, you know, all of these different adventures that you've done in your life? And I know that you also take folks that are disabled or have that are deaf, for example, on trips as well, so that they can hear and experience the outdoors.
After Mount Kilimanjaro, and a number of doors opened up, and one was coming home and then getting on Good Morning America and then sharing the story of everything, both on the internet and public speaking, started to open up the inevitable question too about what's next. So I realized that I was being asked and I could contribute in more ways than I ever thought possible. I was particularly struck by the fact of like being asked to go to South Africa to be the guest of the government to come and talk about apartheid, which I thought had been a racial issue, only to find out that it affected all levels of society in South Africa. And one of the ones that were marginalized and hurt very deeply were the disabled and physically challenged community. So, you know, you do it to like climb Kilimanjaro and summit. And the next thing you know, people are asking you to talk in a foreign country like South Africa, and you hardly feel worthy of that honor and the ability. But it showed me that, as we talked about, the significant meaning and impact piece, that it's possible. You know, you can affect more people than you ever thought possible. So I set out some immediate goals. I hope to basically every 12 to 18 months do another adventure. And in it, it was about advancing what a deaf blind man could do. And in so doing, the focus is to help people get to a better place in the world. And so I've continued that. So shortly thereafter, I did do the Boston Marathon as the first deafblind person to do it. But really, the purpose of running was my 50th birthday. I found out that my three sons could take a portion of the race and guide me, and we could cross the finish line together, which was an amazing picture and event to cross to Boston with your three sons. And it was my 50th birthday. But really, the reason I did it was to raise money for the researchers for my disease that are based right there in Boston. Every year, almost since the 1980s, I've gone there for my checkup, the only place in the world that checks me, does research, and really helps me understand where I'm going in my journey with deaf blindness. And I wanted to thank them and also help them find a cure so that other people don't go through that. The next day I started thinking about it was like, I was alone, mainstreamed as a deaf person. I didn't have what do they call them today? IEPs and ADA and tape recorders for lectures and people that could advocate for me with an educational setting. I mean, I either sat in the front row and heard it or I didn't. And I really felt that it would really help if youth could embrace their challenges early within American culture, especially deaf children. And I wanted them to embrace it and see that it's a part of them, but it doesn't define them. So then I started leading expeditions to take them on adventures. So the first one was the headwaters of the Amazon. The second one was the project with the National Park Service to study sound as we river rafted through the Grand Canyon. And then the third one was to go back to Peru and actually visit deaf orphanages and see what it was like to be deaf in a third world country and realize the blessings that you have, even though you feel like you've got a very difficult challenge in America. When you see the perspective of what it's like to be deaf in other cultures, you realize how lucky you may be. And then my most recent one was to take a group of from all challenges, cerebral palsy, blindness, deafness, cancer, suicide, drug addiction. We went to Nepal to experience what Nepal has to offer in the Himalayas and help them find ways to get past what they have had in their life. Because I see adversity challenges and the things that people face as a life skill. You know, that we all are going to be forced, we're all going to hit them over and over in our life. We don't talk about them, we pretend like it's never going to happen, but we're all going to hit these walls, barriers, and challenges. And what really defines is what we do with them. And so it's important to reinvent yourself, re-engage yourself over and over again, because that's how you survive. I mean, that's how you get resilience and determination and find out that life is really the marinating in both the pain and the glory. So that's important to me with teens. The Boston, the first time was research. The second time was the year after the bombing. 300 people had been injured with vision and hearing problems to require lifetime care from the bombing because of the pellet. So in 2014, I got together with a group of 50 other people and we did the Boston Marathon. My son wanted to run the full marathon by himself rather than guiding me like the time before. So we did it together. So I helped him reach his goal, but as a group, the 50 people raised over $850,000 to help these people get the surgeries, technologies, and things that they need for the rest of their lives. They were caught in a random event that forever changed their lives. And that was the purpose of doing the Boston Marathon. The Camino de Santiago for me was about backpacking for 500 miles across Spain. It's one of the world's oldest and longest hikes. And it's been going on for hundreds of years. In the 80s, about 20,000 people did it. And now we're close to over 400,000 people from around the world do it. It's about checking out and walking, literally walking day by day with nothing but your backpack. You're checked out. You're not checking the news. You're not really connected to the phone. You're finding yourself in a journey of walking step by step. And you meet all these people from cultures from all over the world that you just randomly see. Sometimes many people day after day. Sometimes just for a few days, and sometimes just once. But it's an amazing process that I really kind of helped crystallize for me that, you know, it's in the service of others and getting the word out that, you know, it's possible for anybody to do anything. And I had three friends that said, yeah, a dip line guy can hike 500 miles and we can have a great time doing it. And we can also share a message of hope to people. So that trip has led to one of my upcoming adventures next June, where I'm going back to the Camino, where I'm doing a shortened version for a few days. I'm actually going to push a guy in a wheelchair with my wife and some friends. And we're going to push people in wheelchairs that have never been on any adventure before and have them experience what I experienced 3 years ago by walking all 500 miles. It's really just about helping them figure out that it's possible. And there are ways around it. And you can build a rope team and people around you to help you get to where you want to go and stay connected to the things that are around you.
Bill, I would love to hear a little bit about the coping skills that you've developed over this time period, just to get through your day-to-day that might be helpful for others to know about.
I'm laughing because it's very messy. I mean, I have good days and I have really bad days. In all honesty, you know, this is the time of year that's one of my tougher times because with a reduced level of light, you know, in the northern climates and stuff, seasonal affective disorder, those types of things really start to mess with my sleep, start to mess with my ability to focus and concentrate, and then just deal with what I have both on the hearing and vision side of things. So the coping piece of it is really comes around a number of different things. One is accepting yourself, realizing that you have your constraints and challenges. That's one piece. Another piece is surrounding yourself with what I call the rope team. I mean, people that really care about you, people that will listen to you, people that want to help in some way or capacity, that you just feel have an emotional connection to you and your success, and that you matter, either to them or you matter to life or things around you. And that really means getting over yourself and saying, you know, I need help. And I mean, I have to ask people to help me go to the bathroom in a restaurant sometimes. I mean, I need people to give me a ride. I need, you know, people to, you know, do lots of things in my life. I have a guide dog to take some of that load off so my wife and kid don't feel like that they're guide dogs, you know, human guide dog. You know, they do more than that for me. Because we have an emotional and human connection as well. So the coping thing is really building a good team around you. And that's important as well. But that also means mental health professionals. It can also mean friends that you don't even know. But I also founded a nonprofit, you know, over 10 years ago called No Barriers USA. And what we do there is really focus on help people get past the challenges and barriers they're facing in their life, whether you be a stroke victim, whether you're congenital thing like cerebral palsy, or you've had a car accident, or you're deaf, or you're blind. We don't care what happened to you. What we care about is how you connect back into the human journey. And so I have found in watching and getting in and being around people with as many challenges as they have, it's how inspiring they are, how uplifting they are, how normal they are, how human they are. And I feel like, you know, I'm not alone anymore. You know, in many ways, a lot of times, like, I'm deafblind, my road is difficult, but I also know I would look at my life very much differently than if I had stage 4 cancer and I only had 30 days to live. You know, and I can tell you, I would feel lucky in that moment. So the perspective and the coping piece of it is that, you know, you can't take on your whole life every single day. You can set a broad direction about where you want to go, but take it one step at a time. Try and build on the building pieces and connect them. And in the connections, then you start to find that you have a new path. So for me, you know, doing the Kili was about breaking out. And then starting to do the teen adventures was about having other people in the world around me and helping them get there. And then by doing things like the Boston Marathon and then doing the Camino de Santiago, it's really getting out there and saying, you know, how can I help other people? How can I give back to people what they've given to me? Which is this hope, this optimism, and it's a desire for a better day. So coping is a complex thing because I think that I like to talk about, you know, modern American culture also really tried to tell us that you know, you don't want to work too hard and you should get a really quick payback. And it's all about, you know, individual pursuit of things of independent, you know, that whole Western John Wayne kind of thing that we have in our culture of America, which has tremendous strengths. But when you fall down and you falter and you're really struggling through life, you need to be interdependent. You know, you need the world around you. And so what that requires is getting past yourself and putting others forward in order that we all get stronger. And that's why I like to talk about that analogy of your rope team so much, because we talk about sports a lot, about metaphors and analogies and teamwork and all that. But rope teams are really about people that say, I want to go this direction. I'm going to hold on to this rope and we're going to let this guy lead. And I'm not going to kick a fuss and I'm not going to pull it back. I want to see where we can go and see how we can all get to the top. The goal is for everyone to summit. It's not about 9 people summiting versus 11. Our job is to put everything aside and make that person get to the top. To me, coping is realizing that it isn't going to come from just inside you. It's going to come from the world around you. And it's how you use the tools and resources and other people in the world around you that are going to define your ability to cope. But it doesn't, I guess, if anything, I have all the pain that you would expect that I have, but I like to think that the pain that I go through with it is shorter and I go through it faster because of what has been put into my life and built to this point, if that makes sense. Because I know I'm going to get depressed again. I know I'm going to get frustrated again. I know I'm going to have a hard day this day or that day. So why fight that? If I know it's coming, use the energy to get through the dips and then keep pushing forward. And that's how I see it. It's like kind of the concept of building an ever elevating life.
Bill, you met Mary Beth, your wife, in high school, and then you were married at the age of 25, and you've been married for a couple of decades now, and you have 3 sons. I wonder, how have you two found the balance between spouse and caregiver?
It's a tough one. And as a matter of fact, caregiver stress is real. It's probably not talked about enough. And it is something that, you know, for what I've had to go through on my journey, it's kind of that movie thing we were talking about before. I have to watch her go through the movie of how she's going to be a caregiver and then also retain her sense of identity and independence as a person and who she is, but then also have that be a part of our relationship. My wife has been, she's a perfect wife. I mean, she's the kind of person that she just doesn't take no for an answer. She loves to research. She's very good at connecting, you know, which really helps me because I have trouble connecting because of the blindness and the hearing piece. She can talk to anyone, get their life story, and she can, you know, get to another thing pretty quick. She's been in the caregiving industry for the seniors for the last 7 or 8 years. And so she's watched people go with the challenges of aging and all the things associated in families and caregiving and all that. So she knows the signs. She sees a lot of resources and a lot of it's communication. A lot of it is make sure you have the same goal, making sure that you don't overwhelm the other or expect the other to be what they can't be for you. You know, you can't put the weight of your challenges on them on top of their own challenges. You know, they're humans as well. And then providing opportunities. Like, you know, we got really heavy into early advocacy and researching for blindness and stuff early on when we had our little kid. And then, you know, we said, you know, we got to step away from this. We need to focus on the 3 boys and we need to focus on raising them and being a normal family. And blindness is a part of it. And we will continue to do this work. But we can't do that at the expense of the physical and emotional development of our children. We only have this time for a short period in our life and it was a foundation. And so we adjusted and tailored. And that's important, you know, because sometimes these things can sometimes think like people can feel like it's all about them and what they've got. And it's not about how it's affecting all of us. And it is affecting all of us. And so sometimes there's pretty conversations about it. Sometimes not so pretty. You know, a meltdown can be just as revealing as a simple, clear comment. So we just have to meet each other where it's at. It's a long marathon. We talk about that a lot. It's really something that it's not going away. It's progressive. Aging is the same way. And so we just realized, just like our marriage, you know, you just adjust, tinker, communicate, adapt, modify, but have fun, live it, do stuff. One of the greatest things about all the travel or the adventures I've done is the travel piece. And we both love to travel. So, you know, I mean, I would have never been to South Africa if I hadn't gone Kilimanjaro. And I wouldn't have led expeditions to Peru if I hadn't decided to do the work for teens, or Nepal for that matter. Or I would have been asked to go and raise $1 million for stem cell research in Australia if I hadn't decided to do this work. I've had a lot of fun on those trips. And it's been a great opportunity for us to get closer and do the things that we love, which is be together, have adventures, and be in the great outdoors. I encourage people to just, you can't thank your caregiver enough. And your caregiver is a living, breathing person. They need just as much help in a lot of ways as a person going through it. And I can't tell anyone how they do it, but it gets back to the same thing. We've told our friends where we need help and how we are different. And they have come close and some have not. But we feel better for knowing that we don't deny that we just do things differently. It's how we always say it. We're doing all the same things as everybody out there. We just do it a little differently.
If you could go back to when that earthquake quite literally shook your life up in a big way, if you could go back to yourself when you were 28 years old and you had just received that diagnosis that you were going to go gradually blind, what would you tell yourself?
I think the difference for me would have been realizing sooner that in every waking day and moment of your life, you have only so much energy that resides in your body, most physically, mentally, spiritually. And that I think I spent a lot of that time thinking about what might happen to me and how I was gonna blast past it. When really the question should have been more about getting over myself, like we talked about, embracing life and saying, yeah, it's not what I wanted, but it's still worth living. And how creative can I get to embrace what I have in terms of the fears and challenges that I face and go to do the things that I enjoy doing? How can I have meaning? How can I have significance? How can I have impact? But do it on my tomb. Don't worry about what the world is going to be thinking of me or what they think my progressive past is going to be or that they feel terrible that I'm going to have to go through this devastating and difficult disease. I just don't see myself in that victim mode. I've gone through those parts and I know it's very valid and it's very real and it's just a process we all go through. But I just wish that I could have gone through that faster, more effectively and efficiently, because I think it's impacted other people, you know, those people that are watching the movie and the people that are in this movie with me. And so, you know, I do feel some remorse and regret about how messy or inelegant or how ineffective I may have been. But I am feeling good about accepting things that I've been given. And then imagining my opportunities and my potential from there and realizing there really are no limits. And that, and by doing it, I don't do it for me. I do it for myself and others. And I bring other people along with me. And that's where I see that when I know I'm helping other people and that they see that I'm helping them, then it just feels so much better. It's a much better place to be. It's kind of like at 28, I kind of felt like I was just naked. Body out in the middle of a field. I'm deaf and I'm blind and I could get consumed any moment. You know, that whole fear of flight thing. And now I'm like, I'm in the middle of a field. Where do I want to go? What do I want to do? I'm not afraid of being out in the middle of a field anymore. I want to climb. I want to go do something with it. I want to go see what's out there. And psychologically, it's hard to quantify what that means, but it's huge.
Is there a time that you will be completely in the dark?
Yeah. I mean, that is definitely the path that I will face. But, you know, like I talked about in Founding No Barriers with my friend Eric Weinmayer, he's blind, went blind at age and think is 14. He's the first and only person to have ever summited Everest. I read his book, called him up. He became a friend, asked me to found a nonprofit with him. And he's blind. Every single day I've known him in his life, he's been blind. But every day that I spend with him, I really even think about the fact that he's blind. The man has incredible vision. He has more vision than probably 95% of the people in my life that I know that can see, because it's a light. It's an internal thing. It's about trying to see past what's right in front of you and inside you and realizing that there's something bigger out there. And so he's given me a great, you know, lease on life and understanding that. So I wish I met Eric sooner, but I'm glad I met him. And it's been an incredible journey.
So you and Eric developed these six life elements for No Barriers: vision, reach, pioneer, rope team, alchemy, elevate. Can you tell us about those?
Yes. Yeah. So those are life elements. And to be honest with you, we didn't just create them out of the air. What happened was is that we have probably served over thousands and thousands, let's say, in the last decade of people, whether you come back from the military with missing limbs, or they're blind or deaf from military service, or whether it's somebody who's been stroke victim, or whether someone's cerebral palsy, or someone born without limbs. You name it from life, we've worked it through our programming, both for vets, adults, and children. In doing it, we heard hundreds of stories of people and those barriers and challenges they faced. And then we started to document them all, and then we started to analyze them all. And then they started to fall into the six buckets that you just described. We started to realize that there's a trail map to getting past the barriers and challenges in your life if you're willing to look at it. After you get past yourself, it's possible. You just get so inspired when you hear the stories about how people get to where they are, and we're sitting in the mountains in Sierra and somebody's in a wheelchair and they're going to go rock climbing. It's just so cool. They all tell us different themes, and they come around those words that you mentioned. The first thing they tell us is that I had to do something that was bigger than me. I just had to move. I had to create a bold vision. It was in creating that vision that got me moving towards something and made me realize that I could contribute something bigger than myself. It's that significance and meaning and impact that I talked about earlier. Then the other thing is that you hear them talk about is like, you know, they had to reach. You know, I just needed some new skills, new confidence, new experiences. You know, as humans, we're all kind of wired to aspire. You know, we have this ability to tinker, tailor, adapt, and adjust and create tools. So they just say I had to reach. And by pushing myself, I found out it more. And then they talk about, you know, talk to people that say I had a pioneer. A lot of the stuff I talked about with you in my adventure was about pioneering, like be the first deafblind guy to do it. And if creating unleashes innovation, creativity, resilient determination. These are all things that I call the gifts of taking on the barriers and challenges in your life. It's that very struggle and marinating in it till you realize what you're made of. And so that's where the honing and the focus and all the other things that I talked about come from as well. And then the other one we talk about is rope team. And rope team, I've talked about a lot with you as well in this interview. It's like, you know, America is an independent culture, but you also need to live in a bigger context of the world of your community, your office, your work community, the American society, and the world at large. And what are you doing to give back and be a part of it besides just taking it for yourself? You can have all the goals and desires in the world, but once everybody realizes you're just out for yourself, they're going to turn off you pretty fast. People are looking for something that's a little bit more meaningful than that. And more importantly, if you help other people get to where they want to go, whether they've asked or not, that's when you become their best friend. Because it's about sharing. It's about the human journey, and it's about us all becoming stronger. And alchemy is really one of my most favorite ones, which is a lot of what I've talked to you about defining yourself and accepting where you're at, is that, you know, I'm an alchemist, and all these people that I've seen, they get so inspired by our alchemist. I turn my light into gold. Everybody says, deaf blindness, progressive disease, don't want it, can't do it, don't want to do it, can't imagine. And I get that. But you know what? it's when I embraced it and realized that's lead, but just imagine what I can do. I can do Kilimanjaro. I can fly to South Africa. I can go to Australia. I can do the Amazon. I can run the Boston Marathon. I can speak to people in countries all over the world as a public speaker. Then it doesn't seem so crazy. You know, it's like it's where I find happiness, fulfillment, and joy is realizing that I can help other people see things that they hadn't thought possible. And last but not least is the whole piece of elevation. You know, it's kind of that old rule we all have heard in the past, which is like, you know, to whom much is given, much is expected. It's like, you know, you can't be a net taker in this world. And anything you do to elevate somebody one way or another is the true test of leadership. Kind of speak to some of the stuff you like to talk about in your past and in your story. You know, there's an ethos there, ethics and integrity and character about as humans, an obligation to help the next person. And there's like these two cultures in the world, you know, that I had a audience with Pope Francis and he was talking about the two cultures of the world, which I found very powerful. One is the culture of exclusion, and then there's the culture of encounter. The culture of exclusion is where we say based on your ethnic background or your monetary resources or what country you come from or your religion, we categorize and classify you and we put people in boxes. And it's in that that we do those things in our life with the human brain that it causes conflict, war, dissension, and all kinds of negative behaviors because no one ever wants to really be excluded. But then there's the culture of encounter. And the culture of his encounter is to see the person that you see right in front of you, to look in their eyes and realize that that person has a heart, that person has a soul, and that that person has hope, dreams, and fears. That person wants significance, meaning, and impact. They deserve respect. They deserve dignity. And as a result, if you do that to all the people that you see, you know, you do random act of kindness or do something out of the blue for something somebody totally unexpected, you're elevating. You're elevating other people to a place that they hope to get to. And that's one of the noblest gestures that we can all do. So elevation is about building a world built on encounter and respecting everybody for who they are and not telling them who they're not. And if they can get that confidence, maybe they can go higher and do things they never thought possible.
Bill, thank you so much for this inspiring story and for inspiring so many people, disabled or not.
Thank you for having me. And I really like the name of the podcast, The Belly of the Beast, because you have to start there. But when you come out of it, there's an amazing person in all of us, and it's worth going for. So I encourage anybody to dig down, dig deep, and reach. And you'll be surprised. You can go places that you've never thought possible. But it's when you reach that intersection of possible and impossible, just never underestimate the power of the human spirit. You can do it. And I believe we've yet to see things in our lifetime that we never thought possible by people who have challenges.
Thank you very much.